and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Charges dropped against the Broadview Six and no special prosecutor for ICE agents.
This is reimbursing people that were horribly treated. It's anti-weaponization.
Questions over the legality of President Trump's $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund.
She's an animal in this room.
The person behind this mask is like aching to be her in real life.
And meet a young Chicago woman hoping to someday take her professional wrestling skills to Mexico. First off tonight, a federal grand jury has indicted another Chicago man related to an Operation Midway Blitz incident. Federal prosecutors say 21-year-old Diego Emmanuel Reyes allegedly rammed his SUV into the rear of a truck driven by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in the Brighton Park neighborhood. They say this video shows Reyes using his car to push the ICE agent's car forward before speeding off. The incident happened in the same neighborhood, and on the same day, a Chicago woman, Marimar Martinez, was shot 5 times by an immigration agent. Higher fuel prices have led to higher airfares, but that is not stopping the more than 2 million passengers expected to pass through Chicago airports this holiday weekend. Memorial Day tends to kick off the summer travel season, and the Chicago Department of Aviation says O'Hare traffic is expected to be up more than 15.5% over last year. Midway is expected to see a 3% increase. The city says tomorrow will likely be the busiest day for both airports. All of this despite airfares being nearly 21% higher in April than a year earlier. That's according to the latest Consumer Price Index. And Chicago's beach season officially begins tomorrow as Memorial Day weekend, again, ushers in that unofficial start to summer. Beaches will be open daily from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., with swimming allowed only when lifeguards are on duty from 11 a.m. to 7. This summer, city officials have taken extra steps to enforce paid parking. New gates and license plate readers have been installed at several lakefront lots to make sure drivers pay up. Chicago-born rapper Common and local indie rock band Beach Bunny will headline this summer's Taste of Chicago Festival. Also set to perform are reggae artist Original Coffee, R&B legend Babyface, and Mexican pop star Julieta Venegas. The Taste is returning to July for the first time in 3 years after being moved to September because of the NASCAR Chicago Street Race. City officials say this year's event will expand from 3 days to 5 and feature 39 more food vendors than last year, with about 38% of vendors making their Taste of Chicago debut. And there's more Chicago Tonight coming up, but first we want to share details about a special upcoming event. You're invited to join us for a WTTW News Town Hall about police community relations in Chicago. It's on Tuesday, May 26th at 6 p.m. at Talia Hall in Pilsen. You can reserve your free tickets at WTTW.com/events. Tickets are limited, so sign up today. Again, WTTW.com/events, and we will see you there. Up next, a whirlwind day in Chicago area courts. Our Matt Masterson joins us next to break it all down for us.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
One Midway Blitz saga ends while another goes on. Federal prosecutors today dropped all charges against the remaining Broadview 6 defendants. Separately, a Cook County judge will not appoint a special prosecutor to investigate alleged misconduct by federal immigration agents. But the door is still open for local law enforcement to collect evidence. WTTW News reporter Matt Masterson joins us now with more. Matt, why did feds drop all the charges in the Broadview 6 case?
Brandis, it was really a stunning day at the Dirksen Federal Building today. Prosecutors' conduct, or rather misconduct, before the federal grand jury that indicted these initial six Broadview defendants That's what led to the dismissal today. These six, of course, were accused with conspiring to surround a ICE vehicle in suburban Broadview and impede its progress. What we learned today was that an initial grand jury that this case was presented to refused to indict. Prosecutors then removed some members of that grand jury and presented the case a second time to secure the indictment against them. They also, one of the prosecutors spoke with a member of the grand jury outside the confines of those proceedings, and pages of transcripts that were supposed to be presented to the judge in this case from that grand jury proceeding went missing. They were not presented to the judge as they were supposed to be. None of that, of course, is allowed during the grand jury process. Defense attorneys in this case, some of whom are former federal prosecutors themselves, said they were sickened. They had never seen any type of behavior like this before. They said they were shocked. They called for sanctions against some of these prosecutors who handled this. And they want to see these people held accountable for the way that this case played out.
Like you said, those are really stunning revelations. Yeah. What did the U.S. attorney, Andrew Boutros, have to say?
Boutros made a surprise appearance in court. He was the one who announced this dismissal today. He said he was upset by this conduct. He said he's never seen anything like this happen in his office before. He claimed that he ordered the dismissal of the top felony conspiracy count just weeks ago when he learned what happened. He apologized to the court, but he also stood by the charges that his prosecutors were set to go to trial on just next week. They were still going to go to trial on misdemeanor counts against these defendants starting Tuesday.
Okay, so moving on to the decision to not appoint a special prosecutor, what prompted the judge to consider this issue?
There was a petition filed by 400 elected officials, attorneys, community organizers, who demanded a special prosecutor be brought in after state's attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke has refused, they say, to bring any charges in federal ICE cases stemming from Operation Midway Blitz. The petitioners claimed that O'Neill Burke had abandoned her duties to investigate, but O'Neill Burke claimed that she doesn't have that ability to investigate. Any cases that comes to her, it needs to be started by law enforcement. Police need to do this, and then they bring this investigation to her. She cannot start an investigation on her own. And today, Judge Erica Reddick, who was in charge of deciding whether or not to appoint a special prosecutor, she agreed with O'Neill Burke. She said that these investigations cannot be started by a prosecutor's office. They can't run their own police agency. They need to have these investigations first brought to them before they can consider any charges.
Okay, so to that point then, have law enforcement agencies and other states, have they responded to the accusations of misconduct by immigration agents?
Elsewhere, we have seen similar investigations go forth in Minnesota just this week. An ICE agent was charged in a non-fatal shooting. Nothing like that has happened here yet, but the Illinois State Police this month did request assistance in investigating the fatal shooting of Silverio Villegas Gonzalez by a federal agent last year. O'Neill Burke's office is supporting that investigation, but they say they're not in the primary role. They say they can't, that's what they can't do. They can't initiate. The petitioners now say that to go forward with this, they need people who say they were victimized by ICE agents during Midway Blitz to go to police officers, go to police agencies where they are, and make complaints, and that those complaints need to be investigated before anything can go forward.
Okay, wow. Big day at the federal courthouse today. Matt Masterson, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandon.
And you can read Matt's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. A vote today on a major immigration package was paused by Senate Republicans over news of President Trump's $1.776 billion IRS settlement fund. The so-called anti-government weaponization fund was created following a lawsuit that President Trump and two of his sons filed against the IRS after their financial information was leaked. The fund is dedicated to those who have been supposedly wronged by the Department of Justice, and Trump alluded to giving the money to political allies, including those who participated in the January 6th insurrection. But it has experts and Congress members raising eyebrows. Joining us now are Harold Krent, professor at Chicago Kent College of Law and author of the book Presidential Powers, and Jordan Gans Morse, associate professor of political science with a focus on corruption and authoritarian institutions at Northwestern University. Gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
So, Harold Crinn, I want to start with you because the New York Times is reporting that this settlement happened just days before a federal judge was set to rule on the legitimacy of the Trump's lawsuit over the IRS. Can you break down that original lawsuit that the Trumps filed?
So the lawsuit was filed because personal information and tax returns, which are not supposed to be released, were released inadvertently by the IRS. They traced it to a independent contractor, so not an employee of the IRS, who, without authority, leaked that information to the New York Times and Politico illegally. Indeed, that individual is facing jail time, I think for 5 years in jail. Nonetheless, the president and his sons sued the IRS for this failure to keep his information confidential. The lawsuit was a long shot. It had very little to go on because the mistake was not made by the IRS, it was made by this independent contractor, and he waited too long to sue, so it was probably out of time. The statute of limitations had run. So the question is now, sets up, is this settlement bogus? Is this a settlement of a lawsuit that had no legs to stand on? Or is this really a legitimate settlement of a suit, in which case he would be authorized to tap into the Department of Justice judgment fund in order to pay it?
And that was like a $10 billion lawsuit, wasn't it? Like, also a bit strange, the president to sue his own government.
It is a bit strange and shows the endemic conflicts of interest which are at the core of this administration, but it can happen. And in this case, it's even become worse, of course, as you could see by laying out the information. He calls for this anti-government weaponization fund, a sweet $1.76 billion. Yes.
And as in 1776, as in 1776.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And who's it going to go for? It's going to go for his friends who were similarly victimized by a weaponized Department of Justice during prior administrations, not his.
And this money is, you know, being taken from funds that are typically given to people who do win lawsuits in a court of law against the Justice Department. But how is it that the president is able to gain control over it and say, and, you know, order, you know, one of his departments, one of his agencies to use it for this purpose?
It's a violation of congressional legislation. So it's up to Congress to stand up and try to fight back. Congress says there is a judgment fund, and if you win a lawsuit against the government, you can get paid, which is good, and if you have to settle your case, you can get paid. This isn't a settlement. This was, they voluntarily withdrew the action, which was probably frivolous to begin with, and then used that as just an excuse. It's brazen. It's a brazen use of this mechanism to help support, signal his allies he has their back.
Jordan, does this meet your definition of corruption?
Absolutely. I think the way political scientists usually think of corruption is the abuse of public office or materials or resources for private gain or political gain. And clearly for political gain, given that this is going to be money that's controlled by people who have a strong alliance with Trump and is going to be used in ways that help him politically, that alone makes it corruption. To the extent that there's additional measures that perhaps shield Trump and his family from additional sorts of that allow them to violate tax law, that would also be personal gain that he's going to get from this. So in multiple ways, this looks like corruption to me.
How is this fund and how it's being established, this entire move, how is it different from other cases of corruption or alleged corruption that you study?
One thing that really strikes me is how openly Trump does everything. And this seems almost, I don't know if this is something that he does intentionally or if he just doesn't understand, you know, in his mind, the things he does are not problematic. But even in places that I look at, including places like Putin's Russia, dictators still care about being perceived as corrupt. Even when they have a lot of power, they don't want to be unpopular. And corruption is unpopular in many, many places. And so somebody like Putin, to the extent that he's doing various corruption schemes, tries to keep them somewhat quiet. Trump just does them right in front of us, which creates sort of a conundrum.
And has a press conference about it.
Yeah, that's right. And it creates somewhat of a conundrum because, you know, part of you looking and that goes, well, if it's so bad, he wouldn't just do this out in the open. But it really is that bad, and he's just doing it right in front of our faces, which is really unusual.
Could that burn him later on if that is the case, if this is corruption and it is found to be so?
I would like to say yes, but we've seen Trump defy the laws of political gravity over and over and over again to the point where any sort of guess like that seems like wishful thinking, given that many, many things that would have sunk any other politician in just about any political system have just not hurt Trump, at least not with his base.
Harold, are there any legal safeguards to rein this in?
Well, let me just answer a different question first. I mean, I think this is corruption, but I think this goes deeper than corruption. Because if you take this in conjunction with the pardons given out to the January 6th insurgents, what you see is a message that Trump is sending. I have your back. If you do my bidding, even if it's illegal, if you go out and riot, if you go out and attack a policeman, if you go whatever, as long as you're doing it in my
government,
in my service, I will pardon you, I will give you money, I will compensate you. So look what may happen at the midterms. That's my fear, that the message will be received in that way, as people will say, hey, this president is giving us a signal to go and be violent. That's the risk.
So it seems like Congress is reacting today, although they're going out of town now for the Memorial Day weekend. But it sounds like there were some concerns from even Republicans about, you know, about passing their Homeland Security package. Yet this is happening out in the open, as we've discussed. Is Congress likely to get involved in pressuring the president or to cancel this fund even during a midterm year?
It might. You know, let's hope. This is a violation of Congress's appropriations power. This is taking the judgment fund and using it for personal purposes, violates a whole raft of federal laws. There's also lawsuits, long shot lawsuits. There's already been one filed. The problem with the lawsuit is you have to have someone who's been injured by this. And you have to sort of say that because of the president giving out money to his friends, I will likely be affected poorly because I'm more likely to get beaten up. I'm more likely to be investigated or something like that. So that's a difficult, it's a long road to go into court. The better option and the more direct is what may happen in Congress is to say, President, you've gone too far. This is not what the judgment fund's about. We don't like what you're doing here, and we're going to withhold legislation that you want until you change and cancel what you've done.
Jordan, the Republican Senate, as we mentioned, they paused a vote on the immigration enforcement package. How is this impacting the GOP's leverage with Democrats in negotiating?
I would think that Democrats are happy to finally see at least some GOP support for reining in Trump. But again, as I said before, we simply have seen Trump operate in a different political universe. And we've also just seen a number of primary elections where Trump's power is still really, really visible to Republicans. And if you go against him, it's really clear what he can do to politically harm you. So I'm cautiously optimistic that Republicans are speaking out, but we'll have to see where things really go.
Harold, two officers, as you mentioned, who were defending the Capitol on January 6th, they are suing to block the funds from being given out to those people who participated in the insurrection. Is that the long shot that you were speaking
of?
And why
shot.
Is that a long shot?
They have to show individuated injury under our laws now to go into court and get to trigger any kind of judicial consideration. And they have to show that because of this fund being given out to Giuliani or whomever, that they will more likely face some kind of injury in the future. That's a lot of attenuation, a lot of speculation between giving out money to the January 6th protesters or insurgents and the fact that something may happen in the future. It could happen, and a court could say, you know, it's more likely to happen to cops than to happen to somebody else to have this kind of injury, and therefore open the courthouse doors to consider it. But there's a lot of steps to go through before the court can be comfortable with taking on this case.
Jordan, you know, as we mentioned, you study authoritarian governments in other countries. Yet you say we're not there yet. How would you describe Trump's playbook and where we are in that playbook?
I think Trump himself certainly exhibits many characteristics of somebody who's an authoritarian leader. He would like not to be bound by constraints. And we know that he openly admires authoritarian leaders. In terms, though, of America's system as a whole, we still have had, up to this point at least, free and fair elections. And until that is violated, we still, I think, are in a democratic system, but one that is under a lot of pressure. And this is just one more example of that. Just to name a few things, and some of it already been mentioned, but this is just showcasing the lack of autonomy of the Department of Justice at this point. It's also showcasing the breakdown of separation of powers, as mentioned in terms of the usurpation of Congress's power of appropriation and the purse. And it's also really raising serious concerns about supporting and encouraging political violence, as was just mentioned.
Okay, and you mentioned, you know, free and fair elections. We've got one coming up. Some primaries are still happening. We had some earlier this week. And of course, the midterms in the fall. So we'll be watching it all. Harold Krent, Jordan Gansmoris, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Up next, how women are literally fighting norms in Mexican professional wrestling. But first, a look at the weather. Lucha Libre, or free wrestling, is woven into the fabric of Mexico's cultural identity. It's an acrobatic, flamboyant, and thrilling choreographed sport that melds athletics and theater to symbolize the ultimate battle between good and evil. Luchadoras, female Lucha Libre wrestlers, are challenging the sport's machismo culture. And as Lucha Libre has spread across the world, Chicago has become a hub in the United States. In partnership with WTTW News, students from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism went on a reporting trip to Mexico City. Here's Sydney Meyer and Jamie Gary.
Lucha Libre is woven into the fabric of Mexico's cultural identity. Acrobatic, flamboyant, thrilling. The sport's a choreographed dance of athletics and theater, a battle between good and evil. Arena Mexico is called the Cathedral of Lucha Libre, which makes Mexico City the Vatican. So then it's no surprise that these spaces are also totally male-dominated. But luchadoras challenge this machismo, thriving in spaces few women are found. Meet Dulce Luna.
Sé que cuando piso un ring, Dulce Luna se transforma. Y dentro del personaje, pues, soy una persona extrovertida, no me da miedo la gente, hago cosas que como persona no las haría.
Dulce Luna started training at 19 after observing a training session.
Pero sí había una mujer justo en el primer entrenamiento que les comento que observé y por eso me nació la idea de empezar a entrenar, así como de que dije, hay una chica, yo también puedo.
Women were banned from wrestling in Mexico City from 1954 to 1986. Outside the capital, promoters were penalized for booking professionals like Dulce Luna. Stadiums like the iconic Arena Mexico, now painted with empowering messages, were inaccessible. But this machismo culture is still prevalent.
Lucha Libre is a men's sport. If you see the female wrestlers, you have to show that you are not just sexy, that you have to fight well. If you want to try Lucha Libre, you are not going to find a group for just female wrestlers. You have to go and train with other guys.
The Mexican people have taken Lucha Libre global, and Chicago's become a hub in the United States. A Mexican-American in the second city, Lady Tigres doesn't just train with men. She competes against them, embodying the strength of luchadoras back in Mexico.
To me, when you wear a mat, it changes who you are. Once you get out those curtains, you're not the person who you are behind them. You're the person with the mask. I feel like I'm this ferocious feline from the jungle who's willing to pounce and attack or chew up anyone in a heartbeat.
She's an animal in this room.
The person behind this mask is like, they're like aching to be her in real life.
Lady Tigres grew up watching Lucha Libre with her dad, who immigrated to the United States from Mexico. Seeing other plus-size luchadoras thrive despite pressure to be small and sexy inspired her to start training herself.
I'm a big girl, wrestling other like little petite girls. This gives me an advantage. I do a lot of like power moves. It's like a lot of body slams, power bombs, clotheslines. My signature move is the spear. It made me feel comfortable in who I am, not just in the ring, but outside the ring.
What's your dream as a wrestler?
Hopefully reach Mexico one day. Mexico is mi país, whether I'm born there or not.
For me, I think represents every part of the story of Mexico. Not just a lucha libre, just it's a part of the evolution of the country.
From Northwestern Medill and WTTW, this is Sydney Meyer and Jamie Guerra.
And you can see much more Medill reporting from Mexico City on our website at WTTW.com/news. Back to wrap things up right after this.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices.
And that's our show for this Thursday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the Week in Review. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.